to a regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hopefully you had a fantastic weekend getting ready for Halloween at the end of this week. Oh boy, fun times. I'm not decorating this year. I never really got into decorating. I live on a farm. Nobody ever sees this place except for me, family, the person who Amazon delivery person, the mail person. But that's about it. So, yeah, not decorating. Won't be handing out any candy. Have never ever had a visitor to the farm on Halloween, which is fine. When the kids were younger, we would go into town and do the Halloween thing. But I think I might be dressing up on Friday. I've got a guest hosting karaoke gig, so I may be in costume for that. But other than that, no Halloween plans. I tell you what, though, on today's program, we do have a great conversation about some scary stuff. Mark Walters from Armed American Radio joining us, talking about the Hamani case. This is the case that the Supreme Court just approved. It is taking. It's a challenge to, actually, it's the government's challenge to the dismissal of criminal charges for possessing a firearm under unlawful, under Section 922G3, which prohibits unlawful users of drugs from possessing guns. Also talking about Maine's red flag referendum, which will be going before the voters here next week, and will determine whether or not the state of Maine will establish a red flag law. The ballot language is relatively simplistic, I should say. I don't want to say simple. Simplistic, I think, is a better word. And then the actual definition of how this red flag law would work runs to, I think, it's something like 22 pages. I mean, there's no way that the voters in Maine are going to comb through every paragraph of that to figure out how this red flag law is going to work. I am very concerned about this, but also the proposal itself, I think, is a step in the wrong direction for Maine. So anyway, we've got a lot to talk about with the Mark Walters, host of Armed American Radio. Take a look and a listen. Mark, thank you very much for joining me on the program, sir. It's good to talk with you once again. Another Mondays with Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Cam. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, you bet. And we're just talking off the air. So you had Jared Yanis on the Sunday Monster Cast last night, talking about U.S. versus Hamani. This is the case, second case this term that the Supreme Court has taken dealing with our right to keep and bear arms, specifically this dealing with Section 922G3, which prohibits unlawful users of drugs from possessing firearms. And you said that Jared did sort of a deep dive into this case, right?
He did, and I'm going to highly recommend that all of our viewers and listeners go view Guns and Gadgets if you're not already signed up. Jared, of course, YouTube sensation with about 770,000 followers over there. Let's help him get to 1 million, by the way. His work is fantastic. But he did a really deep dive into this case. When you and I talked last, I think I made the comments that you're going to see a lot of American weed smokers, otherwise law-abiding citizens, who might live in states where marijuana has been decriminalized for either recreational or both recreational and medicinal purposes. You see a lot of happy folks. Because if you just look at this case on the surface, that would appear to be the case. And you and I were talking about it possibly being a 7-2, maybe even a 9-0 decision. Well, when you dig deeper into this, which I did after watching him, and I started reading some more about this, this is a really bad guy. This is far worse than Rahimi. And you and I talked about Rahimi being a terrible plaintiff, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes one of these guys to get to the level of the courts that we're at right now. But this guy's a terrorist. This guy's an Iranian terrorist sympathizer who made it clear to federal investigators that if he were aware of an impending attack in the United States, he would say nothing and allow it to occur. He's a dual citizen, Pakistani and American, terrorist Iranian sympathizer with family ties. In fact, his mother said that she hopes her sons wind up like martyrs when they were all at Soleimani's funeral.
Right. Yeah.
This is a very bad person. Now, so that begs a lot of questions. As Jared points out, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, but we discussed it last night in detail on Armed American Radio, you have the most self-proclaimed pro-Second Amendment administration in history. And I think we're all in agreement with that being the case. But no one's perfect. We've got to ask a lot of questions about this. Why is the government pursuing this case? Because if, in fact, they win at the Supreme Court, you're going to have a terrorist self-proclaimed terrorist who will not be able to lawfully purchase a firearm because of his weed. And I mean, I guess he was caught with weed and cocaine. This is a bad guy all the way around. But you're going to have millions and millions of Americans get caught up in a decision like that. Still, and it begs the question, you know, so there's a lot to ask about this. You got to take a deeper dive into the case. I still do.
Yeah. All right. So a couple of things. So, you know, the reason why the government's appealing this case is because the Fifth Circuit said that Mr. Hamani's conviction on 922G3 couldn't stand. Right.
Right.
The Fifth Circuit says that there are laws that prevent people from actively possessing a firearm while they're under the influence, but that there's no historical tradition of banning users of intoxicating substances from keeping and bearing arms. So I'm not surprised to see the government appeal this case. But I think to Jared's point, there were five cases dealing with Section 922G3 that the Supreme Court had in conference. This is the case that they took.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the case that the government wanted them to take. Why? Because, again, the facts surrounding the defendant are so bad, right?
Right.
This isn't somebody who was caught with, you know, marijuana residue in a car and had a firearm in the vehicle and said, well, yeah, I smoke pot maybe 14 times a month. That's not this case, right? That's the Daniels case, essentially. So I'm not surprised to see the government take this case. I'm not really surprised, but I'm disappointed that the government wants to see Hamani as the vehicle because, again, from the government's point of view, this is, I think, the case where the Supreme Court is most likely to reverse the Fifth Circuit or reverse a lower court decision and say, yeah, this guy can't own guns, right? But then the question still becomes, how broad a ruling are we talking about here?
Well, that's the kicker. That right there, you just nailed it. It depends on how broad the scope of the ruling is. There's a lot that can happen here. We know from past history, when you take a guy like Roberts, for example, the Chief Justice, he's loath to get the courts involved in many areas where he feels that it should be handled legislatively, right? But that would harken back to why he might not want to take a case to begin with. They've taken the case out of conference. I have no idea where Roberts fell in that decision. I have no clue. But you're right. The broadness of that ruling is going to impact millions of other Americans. Now, I want to believe that the government's going after this because they don't want this guy to have a firearm, et cetera. And there's that part of me that wants to trust the government that doesn't trust the government that says, well, you know, historically, the feds have not really gone after weed smokers in this country on the 4473 in violation of the 922G, as you point out. They just really don't do that. I don't have the numbers of how many people may have been caught up in that or how many people may have been prosecuted. I would guess it would have to be pretty egregious for that to happen because millions of Americans smoke pot and buy guns. But in fact, they are lying on that 4473, Cam. So the broadness of this ruling is huge. And here's that, to get back to that, I would like to believe that the federal government is going to, after they get whatever they do to him, whatever they want done to him, whatever ruling they get, is going to leave the rest of those millions of Americans alone.
There's
my answer. It's fascinating to watch.
It is. Do I trust the government to do the right thing? No. Right. And, you know, as we've talked about on this program before, both with yourself and with, folks from like Brandon from the Firearms Policy Coalition, you know, the DOJ is being very aggressive at going after state level gun control laws for violating the Second Amendment. At the same time, they're defending a lot of federal gun control laws. I think that's fair to say, right? And this is obviously a federal gun control law we're talking about. But, you know, I don't know if this came up in your conversation with Jared last night. So there's basically a four-way circuit court split over Section 922G3, which I think is one of the reasons why the Supreme Court took a case, not necessarily this case, but why they took a case. Fifth Circuit, as I said, says that 922G3 unconstitutional in almost every application, right? Seventh Circuit says it's fine in every application. Third Circuit and Eighth Circuit say, and they've got slightly different tests, but basically that there needs to be a finding of dangerousness, that it's not going to just be cut and dry, that anybody who's an unlawful user of drugs can own a gun, that you need to show that they're dangerous. And this is where I think it gets really interesting, Mark. So the two of the five cases that the Supreme Court had in conference that they've now rejected outright are cases out of the Eighth Circuit. Mm-hmm. And so they've allowed these Eighth Circuit's decisions to stand. The Eighth Circuit said, again, that there needs to be an individualized finding of dangerousness. Now, one of these cases, I think it was the Baxter case, the Eighth Circuit said to the trial court, go do that individual assessment. And the court did and said, yeah, this guy's a bad guy, right? He's got gang ties. He's on social media, using drugs, flashing guns at the same time. He's dangerous. And so I can understand why maybe the Supreme Court didn't see the need to review that case, right? Okay, well, let's just kick this down. No reason to appeal. The other case, I think it was Cooper versus the United States. When the trial court did its analysis, they found that, no, he's not dangerous. Mm-hmm. And they dismissed the indictment. So he can own a gun as an unlawful user of drugs. And the Supreme Court allowed that decision to stand. So that they could have held on to that case until after Hamani was decided and then, you know, vacated the lower court decision, remanded it back down to the Eighth Circuit for a do-over. They didn't do that. So I'm reading the tea leaves. I talked about this with Costas Morris from the Second Amendment Foundation last week. I think that this is a hint, at the very least, that may be where a majority of the court is coming down, that the Eighth Circuit's rationale is at least broadly acceptable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because if they didn't agree to at least some degree with what the Eighth Circuit had done, again, I think they would have held on to the case where the charges were dismissed mm-hmm. and asked for a do-over. Since that didn't happen, that case, again, that's done. Prosecutors, federal government can't go after this guy for being an unlawful mm-hmm. user of drugs unless they, you know, catch him again. That to me, again, I just think that we're not going to see I doubt we're going to see them side with the Fifth Circuit. But I think that we're going to see the court recognize again that, you know, somebody who eats a gummy to help deal with the side effects of chemotherapy is not the same as a, you know, violent gang member. Who's, you know, smoking dope and maybe using harder drugs as well, right? That's kind of where I come down. And
well, that's what we want to hope.
Yeah.
We want to, but, and, you know, is Trump showing a proclivity here? Because he has rumbled a little bit about possibly removing marijuana from the Schedule One. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, you got Fifth, Third, Eighth, and Seventh Circuits involved here. This was ripe for the Supreme Court. They're going to take one. That is the laid out groundwork to how they decide in conference to take a case. You have massive circuit splits going on here in all of these four circuits. But it will, so let's look at this. This kind of shows me that the federal government might not have any intention of ever removing marijuana from the Schedule One because they can use it in cases like this. Okay.
Possibly.
So, you know,
I don't know that that's going to be. I mean, again, I think that's a Trump decision, and I don't know. I mean, DOJ may be arguing to keep that in place.
Okay, so if they are arguing to keep it in place, here we go.
Yeah.
When they know that this impacts what could be, and we don't know the number, but it's in the tens of millions, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Of otherwise lawful gun owners across this country who smoke marijuana. And I have to point this out because it is critical to the conversation. Weed remains illegal at the federal level, period.
Right.
It is
legal in 40 states for, you know, medical use. I think, 24 for recreational, not as many as constitutional carry, but it's
roughly. We could paraphrase it as roughly half the country. But those states where it's lawful by state law, those state laws are a violation of federal law.
Right.
And we cannot gloss over that.
No, you can't. You can, but you know, but at the same time, the federal government has chosen to largely gloss over that, right? There is, I think, a memorandum of understanding, I think going back to the Obama administration, where the DOJ basically said, all right, we're going to turn a blind eye to, you know, personal possession cases, right? Well, we'll go with drug trafficking, but you know, you don't see the DOJ raiding dispensaries in Colorado or
no. Oklahoma, no, right? you don't.
And so, again, you know, I think weed exists in this weird gray area, both in terms of we know what the federal law says, but in terms of how that law is enforced, again, it's a little bit different, right? It's not necessarily weed isn't treated the same as cocaine or heroin or fentanyl, right? It's it is treated differently by the federal government.
It is when you're buying a gun. It is when you're buying a gun.
Well, that's right.
This is that catch 22. I don't know that we're ever going to get ourselves outside of this trap. I hope viewers and listeners are following along here. You know, we don't see the feds raising dispensaries, but they could if they chose to.
Yes.
So that possibility is real. And that's where Jared is going with this. And let's go even deeper. This all stems from Bruin. This all stems from historical analog in this country.
Yep.
Every one of our founding fathers were master distillers. Most of them grew hemp. Now, they used it for certain things. Who knows? Maybe they were smoking it. I don't know. Probably using it for rope and stuff like that. It would make sense. But it doesn't matter. You go back to that intoxication. You know, it's not illegal to have it only if you're under the influence. Now, supposedly, but then you go back, this wipes all that out. Just the mere having it, even 28 days or 30 days earlier, this catch 22 is dangerous. And I think, you know, infringement is an infringement, period.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to go that direction, then you've got a known terrorist, a sympathizer. There you go.
I think that's going to be.
I don't know that we ever get out of the turn.
I think that's going to be the loophole that the court uses.
Yeah, because I agree.
I think the Fifth Circuit is right, honestly, that there really is no historic tradition of prohibiting all users of intoxicating substances from possessing firearms. If that was the case, again, in 1791, you could argue more people were drinking, you know, hard cider than water.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't you love to have tried that stuff back then?
Honestly, right? So, but as you say, you know, there's a case to be made that beyond Ali Hamani's marijuana use, that this is a dangerous individual, right? And the Supreme Court said in Rahimi that if somebody has been determined to pose a threat to themselves or others, that they can be disarmed. I don't necessarily like how broad that decision was, because I think it opens the door for red flag laws to be upheld. But I suspect that in the Hamani case, if the court wants to determine that Hamani can own a gun, but grandma who eats a gummy can, that it's going to hinge again on that dangerousness aspect of Hamani's case, right?
And keep in mind, too, there's more nuance. A lot of these gummies are part of the Farm Bill from a few years back that are legal under federal law
right.
in every state.
Yeah.
Okay, as long as there's 0.03 or less THC content by weight, which is why you can have a 20 milligram pot gummy. Because it's bigger in size, it's still less than 0.03 THC content by weight. Don't ask me how I know all these things, please. Let's not go there. But the fact of the matter is, I just know because I study this stuff from what we talk about. Let me leave it at that, okay? Let's go. Okay, if it's okay, let's shift to red flags. You brought that up, too. Mm-hmm. And this is interesting out of Maine. Jared and I were talking about this last night, too. Take a dive into what's going on in Maine. Maine has what we refer to as yellow flags, as you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Where we all know the due process that gets flipped upside down on its head. The Constitution is literally turned upside down when you talk about a red flag law. Okay. For all the reasons we know about, won't go into now. Maine's yellow flag, as it currently stands now, is at least has a semblance or a hint of due process because of the requirement of what is necessary in order to instigate a red flag law at all. In other words, it has to be a professional. The decision has to be made by a professional that meets the state guidelines before that can even, it can't be just the neighbor that the Democrats want that don't like you politically that says you're a gun owner, ex parte. Next thing you know, you got somebody banging on your door at 5 o'clock in the morning. Now you're in a death showdown with the cops because you don't even know they're coming.
Yeah.
But that's on the ballot right now. It's running neck and neck, 50-50 in Maine right now. Maine, you got to get up and do the right thing. And interestingly, the Fraternal Order of Police in Maine is against this as well. And as we pointed out on last night's Armed American Radio, not for the reasons we would like to see, but they are against it. What is Maine going to do? You couple that with what's going on in New Jersey gubernatorial, Virginia gubernatorial. We got a fascinating November unfolding in front of us, brother.
We really do. Maine's governor, Jana Mills, has come out against the red flag referendum. Of course, she was one of the architects of the yellow flag law, along with David Tran from Sportsman's Alliance of Maine. And, I'm with you. I saw an op-ed written. It was just a newspaper columnist, but he was talking about the need for this red flag law in Maine. And he argued that the yellow flag law is actually more violative of our individual rights, because in order for the yellow flag law to be put into effect, as you say, has to be initiated by law enforcement, right? And there has to be an examination by a mental health professional rather than a judge hearing one right. side of the argument to decide whether someone's a danger to themselves or others. This requires an assessment from a doctor or a, you know, a nurse practitioner, somebody with that mental health care experience. But that requires that police take somebody into custody. And,
none of that makes this okay. Let me point that out. Right. We're only saying here, ladies and gentlemen, don't sit here and think that, Cameron, I'm going to speak for you now. We're not sitting here advocating for yellow flag laws.
No, but if you're comparing one or the other.
If we're comparing one to the other, and there has to be an issue, you'd much rather have the yellow flag in place than the red. Let's leave it, even though they're both a complete violation of our constitutional rights.
Absolutely. And, you know, and again, I mean, with the yellow flag law, yes, it does require somebody to be taken into custody, at least for the purposes of that mental health evaluation. But that's true for civil commitment laws, too, right? Mm-hmm. When a gun is not, and that to me is what the real a comparison needs to be. If somebody is a danger to them, danger to themselves or others, okay, then you assess whether or not they are the danger, right? The red flag law says, okay, someone's a danger to themselves or others, let's take their guns away, and now they're not dangerous, mm-hmm. which is nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're talking about dangerous individuals, they shouldn't have access to car keys.
They shouldn't be on the street.
Matches. Right, exactly. Right. They need to be somewhere where they can get the help that's needed so they're no longer a danger to themselves or others. But red flag laws have no mental health component whatsoever, neither on the front end or the back end.
Correct. And I want to go to what our good friends David Codry and of course, you remember Alan Corwin years ago. Both these guys made these comments, one in reference to dangerous people walking around, period. The other one in reference to no-fly lists. If you're deemed so dangerous you can't fly on a commercial airliner, why are you walking around? If you can't be trusted with a firearm, why are you even walking around? Now, you know, the red flags, this is a topic we could stay on forever and probably never, ever, ever get out of the holes we dig. But you go back to Florida, the gunshine state, all right? The gunshine state, ladies and gentlemen, uses red flag laws more than any other state in the nation. Mm-hmm. It's the state of Florida. And I did a real deep dive into the actual numbers and the homicide numbers versus how, you know, 1,046 homicides by firearm usage in 2023 was the latest number I could come up with. Florida has used red flag laws 10 times that number. So are you telling me that 10,000 other people's lives were saved? Well, there's no possible way when you go back and look at the historical numbers. No. This is a mess all the way around. I just hope Wayne does the right thing here. I really do.
I do, too. I mean, they did the right thing when it came to background checks in 2016 via referendum. Right. I'm hopeful that they'll do the same thing. But, you know, one more point to the red flag laws. You're right about this. And I've written about this at Bearing Arms. One of the studies that's used to promote red flag laws says that for every extreme risk protection order petition that is granted, I'm sorry, for every 17 to 23 red flag petitions that are granted, one suicide is prevented. So even the supporters of red flag laws have to admit that it's successful around 5% of the time at best.
At best.
At best, right? Which begs the question, what happens in the other 16 to 22 cases, right? Did individuals go on to take their own lives? Did they go on to take the lives of others? Or were they never a danger or a threat to themselves or others in the first place?
Yeah. Now, let's throw a monkey wrench into this. Pam Bondi, back in 2018, who is now our AG of the and I'll just, again, quote Jared, the self-proclaimed most pro-gun administration in history. He's a huge fan of the red flag laws in Florida at the time in 2018. Okay, where does she stand on this now? Now, I am on record, and I will stay on record with this. I do not fear Pam Bondi at the DOJ at all. And the reason I don't fear Pam Bondi is because of Donald Trump. She works at the pleasure of the president. The president has laid down what is, no doubt, the most pro-gun agenda we've seen in any administration in modern history. And I believe, I have to believe, that at least, you know, Pam Bondi is not going to deviate from Trump's initiatives and his directives. She's saying all the right things. Harmeet Dhillon's saying all the right things. We've all seen the videos, okay? But all of these questions still exist. Pam Bondi was a huge fan of red flag laws, and you and I, just in this basic conversation, debunked red flag laws immediately. It's not hard to do. Eventually, the Supreme Court is going to speak on this, Cam. I have no idea when. But at some point in time, you're going to see enough split somewhere that the court addresses this issue of red flags. And it would be really disappointing to see our Constitution turned upside down, upheld by the Supreme Court at that level. I don't think it will happen. But we're getting, again, well, you know, getting ahead of our skis.
You're more optimistic than I am. Like I said, I think Rahimi opens the door for the court to uphold.
It does.
But it does. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Gives us something to talk about every day, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And you're right. We've got Maine. We've got New Jersey. We've got Virginia. Second Amendment is at stake in all of those states. A chance to undo some of the damage in New Jersey. A chance to avoid damage in Virginia. Because I've got to tell you, I mean, as a resident of the Commonwealth, if Democrats have a governing trifecta after the elections, Virginia's
it's Katie like, by the door, brother.
Yeah, it's going to look like East California. I mean, it's scary. But
and you know that, and they're going to do it on steroids. They're going to make no bones about it. They're going to dump a ton of money into it every time for gun safety. He's going to be talking about a referendum. It's a referendum against Trump. It's a referendum against guns. They're going to throw millions at it. You are right, Virginia. Do the right thing.
Absolutely. Mark Walters, host of Armed American Radio. You need to do the right thing by listening to Mark every chance you get. And Mark, as always, my friend, thanks so much for coming on the program. It was great talking to you today.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me, Cam.
My thanks to Mark for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again, maybe as early as next Monday. You never know. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start with a case out of the Bay Area of California, where the East Bay Times reports 13-time felon charged in Hayward robbery where victim was shot after going to ATM. 30-year-old Demaria Adger, the East Bay Times reports, has racked up 13 felony convictions. Not arrest, 13 felony convictions. He's 30 years old. In Contra Costa, Alameda, and Los Angeles counties over the past 12 years since he turned 18. Authorities allege that Adger is part of a gang called NSO, which stands for Northside Oakland. And his prior convictions include charges of assault, burglary, conspiracy, street terrorism, robbery, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. According to the East Bay Times, he has been sentenced to prison before. In fact, 3 years ago, Adger was sentenced to 5 years in prison, but got out last year. So much for the 5-year sentence, basically 2.5 years behind bars. He had gotten in trouble for 5 probation violations since he was released last year, including failing to register as a gang member, absconding, and battery. Despite that, his probation apparently not revoked. Adger was not returned to prison and was out on the streets and allegedly able to participate in this particular robbery. He's been charged with assault with a firearm, second-degree robbery, and gun possession, all stemming from a July 16th robbery where his alleged cohort shot the victim while attempting to rob the man after he visited an ATM in Hayward, California. According to police, the victim had just left a Wells Fargo branch when the suspected shooter accosted him. Adger was wearing what's described as a distinctive shirt with a red spider. Soon joined in the struggle, police reportedly found a near-identical sweater during a raid of his San Francisco home. Adger's accomplice has not been identified or charged, so Adger, the only one charged right now, is currently being held without bail at the Santa Rita Jail in Dublin, California. He is due in court on November the 7th. He has pleaded not guilty, and we will keep our eyes on what's going on here. But, I mean, come on. 13 felony convictions over the past 12 years, and time again, the criminal justice system in California, in Gavin Newsom's California. And remember, Gavin Newsom loves to put gun control laws in the books, right? Loves to penalize lawful gun owners. But what happens when you are a violent gang member? You get break after break. You get plea deal after plea deal. You get sentenced to 5 years in prison, you do 2.5. And when you get out and you violate your probation on nearly half a dozen occasions, nothing at all happens to you. That's Gavin Newsom's California, where the Second Amendment is a suggestion and the soft-on-crime policies reign supreme. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story from Ohio, where a Pickaway County jury has cleared a man of murder charges in a road rage shooting, finding that he instead acted in self-defense. The Columbus Dispatch reports 42-year-old Jason McClain was accused of fatally shooting 55-year-old David Range Jr. Last August during an altercation between the two men in Circleville, Ohio. Last Friday, actually it was last Thursday, a jury found him not guilty of two counts of murder and one count of felonious assault. McClain had argued at his trial that he shot Raines in self-defense. According to court records, McClain and Raines got into an argument as a result of a road rage incident. It's not clear who was the initial instigator, but at one point, Raines got out of his vehicle, took a swing at McClain, who then drew his firearm, shot Raines a single time, hit him in the chest. Raines was taken to a local hospital, but he passed away a short time later. Raines' four adult children filed a wrongful death lawsuit against McClain several months after their father passed away. That lawsuit, according to the Columbus Dispatch, put on hold until the criminal case had ended, according to court records. Raines, a U.S. Air Force veteran, previously worked for the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. And, you know, again, I have said time and time again that these defensive gun uses involving road rage incidents, these are the ones, rarely do I cheer outright at defensive gun use because I hate to see any gun owner put in a position where their life is legitimately in danger. I don't necessarily think that's reason to celebrate. Now, individuals who act in self-defense, who are alive after their life was put in danger because they were exercising their Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, I think that's a good thing. But, you know, these road rage defensive gun uses to me are the most easily avoided on the part of the instigator. If you're driving down the road and somebody does something to tick you off, they cut you off in traffic, they're tailgating you, whatever. Once you are away from that immediate vicinity, once you have turned right and they've gone straight, or they've sped off after weaving in and out of traffic and nearly hitting you, 2 minutes later, you've forgotten about them. If not 2 minutes, 2 hours later, you forgot about them. Right? It's a bad moment. That's it. And yet, in so many of these cases, the road rager cannot let go of that anger. And they escalate this to the point of violence. And to the point, again, where somebody is in lawful and legitimate fear of death or great bodily harm, and they act in lawful self-defense. When their attacker could have just kept driving down the road, could have stopped at that stop sign and let this person pass by. So I don't know all the particulars of this altercation between Jason McClain and David Range Jr., but the jury does, and the jury found that Mr. McClain did not commit murder, but instead was acting in self-defense when he fired that fatal shot. My heart goes out to Raines' kids, his other family, his friends. It's a sad situation. He may very well have been a upstanding guy who let his anger get the best of him. But again, in so many of these cases, that violence could have been avoided if the road rager didn't escalate the violence to begin with, but B, they had just kept on driving and let their anger subside. And a couple minutes later, it would have been a non-issue. That to me is the biggest tragedy in stories like this. All right, on to today's good deed of the day. From California, where a dad and son ended up protecting an unlocked candy shop. Now, I don't know how they realized that the shop was unlocked unless they tried the door. But anyway, this was in Riverside, California. Connor Smith is out for a walk with his four-year-old son. And they realized that this new candy store in their favorite shopping center had left its doors unlocked. And it's nighttime. Shops are closed. As KCBS reports, in surveillance video, Smith tells his son that they need to find a security guard to help lock up the business. So they briefly leave the area to find a phone number for help. And then they come back and they basically stand guard over the shop while they wait for the security guard to show up. Smith ended up reading the bulk candy rules to his son, Charlie. Smith told KCBS and KCAL, he said, "My first thought was that somebody's going to take advantage of the situation. And then what if they want to close because they lose too much inventory and they can't stay open?" He said, "That would bum my kids out, which would bum me out." So the owner of Uptown Candy Shop, they just opened their newest location about a week prior. Owner Danya Farai said, "They just walked off like nothing happened. As if they didn't save my business that night." Well, I don't know what they were supposed to do when the security guard came and locked the door. I mean, at that point, yeah, what, you're going to wait around till morning? Tell the owner what happened? Hope you get a pat on the back? No, you're going to go about your day. But when, anyway, when Farai saw this, she didn't know who the father and son were. So she posted the security footage on social media. She said, "We wanted to thank him, so we posted it on TikTok to get the word out there. We figured TikTok finds the bad guys really fast, so let's see how long it takes them to find the good guy." I didn't realize TikTok finds bad guys. I thought it was just people lip-syncing. But anyway, it only took about a day, and Farage actually was able to connect with Connor Smith. She indeed offered them treats from the shop for being a good neighbor. Connor Smith says, "It feels for real, like I'm living in an alternate reality." I mean, is this the biggest news of the day? No. But it is nice that, you know, a guy did something good for a small business owner, that the small business owner recognized that good deed and did a kindness in return. That's kind of the social contract at work, right? And if not the social contract, the golden rule. So Connor Smith and his son Charlie in the right place at the right time. Willing and able to do the right thing for a small business owner in need and getting their treats a few days before Halloween. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that has got to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I am looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow for the 2A Tuesday edition. I'll be joining my friend Carl Higbee on Newsmax tomorrow night. And, of course, Wednesdays, we've got our VIP Gold and VIP Platinum live chat, 1:30 Eastern time. We're also going to be doing an after party this week with the Hot Air's Ed Morrissey and our VIP Gold and Platinum crew. If you would like to be a part of it, great deal going on right now. While the shutdown is in effect, use the promo code POTUS47 and you can get 74% off of your VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum membership. Great benefits at every tier of support, no matter which one you choose. But if you're a VIP Gold or Platinum member, again, you get to take part in these live chat events. Not only Ed and I, but throughout the Town Hall Media family of writers. It really is a lot of fun. So hope to check it out. Again, POTUS47 is the promo code. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.